Catherine only fussed when she was hungry. And Alix lifted her to say, "Hi, lovey," before she slipped her underneath a complimentary nursing shawl. The fantasies of using Amira's quick typing became quickly laughable because Alix would have to have things to write down in order for them to materialize. In bed one evening, Peter said, "You just look so much happier here." Alix couldn't tell if she was happier or if she just cared less. She had definitely gained weight on top of the baby weight. She wrote much less than she had in New York, and she slept much more than when Briar was born. But at 10:45 p.m. on a Saturday night in September, eggshells smashed against the front window of her home and brought her out of a deep sleep. The sound didn't register right away, but when Alix heard, "Racist piece of shit," it was like she came online. She reached out and touched her husband. Alix and Peter rushed to the top of the stairs and watched egg yolks break and splatter against their front window. Just as Peter said, "I told you," two large eggs broke the barrier. Splintered glass, eggshells, and a long string of yolk and mucus flew into the Chamberlain house. The sound and surprise made Alix's chest seize. She breathed again when she heard boyish laughter, sneakers running away, and someone saying, "Oh shit, go, go!" Catherine cried out, and Briar said, "Mama?" Peter said, "I'm calling the police." And then, "Fuck, I told you this would happen." That morning, Peter's co-anchor, Lainey Thacker, had introduced a segment on the creative ways students were asking their dates to a dance, a sweet homecoming tradition at Beacon Smith High School. Peter echoed her enthusiasm with, "Misty is on campus for the romance right now." Clips of students were shown with Misty's voice narrating. Teachers were interviewed, students were filmed next to huge balloon displays, and the volume at a pep rally turned to screams as a freckled girl was led to the half-court line. A football jersey junior appeared with a box of pizza. He opened it to reveal words inscribed on the box's lid. "I know this is cheesy, but homecoming?" Pepperonis were positioned as a giant question mark below. The segment ended with a 5-foot-tall student with a flat top of thick hair above a white mask marching toward a group of girls. He set down a boombox and pressed play. His masked friends helped clear the space for a dance to begin, and the girl in question covered her mouth as her friends took out their phones. After spinning on their heads and doing intricate shapes and patterns with their fingers, the group ended by revealing a white flag with "Homecoming?" written in Sharpie. The black teen in front removed his mask and held out a rose. Over the cheers of the girls' acceptance, Misty turned the camera back to Peter in the studio. "Whoa," Peter said. "That was very impressive," Lainey agreed. "I was definitely never asked to a dance like that." "Well," Peter shook his head. His teeth showed as he winced at the camera and said, "Let's hope that last one asked her father first. Thanks for joining us on WNFT, and we'll see you tomorrow morning on Philadelphia Action News." The backlash was immediate. In the comment section underneath the video, which was now available online, criticisms and questions popped up in between praise. "Why would the black guy need to ask her dad, but the white guys don't? That's a bit sexist. Is this the 18th century? WTF, why would he even say that?" Alix was working at a coffee shop, which had turned into a smoothie, mimosa, and participating in the group text with her girlfriends in Manhattan. She told Peter that it was one high school, that it wasn't that terrible, and that no one would even remember it. In a weak champagne buzz, Alix caught herself thinking, "If it didn't happen in New York, honestly, who cares?" But Peter was mortified. It just came out, he said. I don't even know why I... It just came out. Alix assured him that it really wasn't that bad. And suddenly, it was. After the crash, Alix took her youngest daughter from her crib with such speed that Catherine practically bounced out of her arms. But Alix's world moved underwater. What if Peter got fired? Peter had gone straight to the producers of the show to apologize for his fumble, and they chalked it up to something between things happen and you're still the new guy. But what if the students were so angry that it made them reconsider? Once again, Alix peeked out over the stairwell and saw flecks of glass strewn across the tile floor and stuck in ooze. Would the Clinton campaign find out about this? And would they think her husband was sexist? Or even worse, racist? How did she even get here? And how is she this fat right now? Whose house was this anyway? Peter carried Briar, who secured both her hands to her ears.
I don't like that noise, she said. I don't like it loud, Mama.
Shh, Alix said to Briar for maybe the 100th time that week. She turned to Peter and said, I'm gonna try Amira. Peter nodded with his phone to his ear. And when Amira arrived 15 minutes later, in a tiny faux leather skirt and strappy heels that she walked remarkably well in, Alix handed Briar's little wrist toward her, thinking, wait a second, who is this person? Oh God, does she know what Peter said? All at once, it was somehow much worse to think of Amira knowing what Peter had said rather than the hopeful first female president of the United States. As Peter gave two policemen a statement, Alix scooped up the glass with a hand towel in the glaring light from the chandelier. In between long, sad strokes, she told herself to wake the fuck up, to write this book, to live in Philadelphia, to get to know Amira Tucker. 3. There's a town in Maryland called Sewell Bridge, where 6.5% of the population, 5,850 people, are hearing impaired. This is the town where Amira Tucker was born. Amira had perfect hearing, the same as her parents and younger siblings, but the Tucker family had a proclivity toward craftsmanship that was so dogged that it leaned into religious territory, and Sewell Bridge served this philosophy well. The Tucker family worked with their hands. Mr. Tucker owned a bee store with a long rooftop where the buzzing beehives were often kept. Despite hiring several deaf employees over the years, he didn't waste any time training his fingers to do anything that wasn't related to bees. Mrs. Tucker bound books in a shaded screened room attached to the front of the Tucker home. She made baby albums, wedding books, and Holy Bible restorations, and her work table was consistently covered in leather swatches, needles, bone folders, and closures. 21-year-old Alfie Tucker won second place in the National Latte Art Competition in 2013. He was invited to serve as an apprentice at a roastery in Austin, Texas, where he trained other baristas, wearing an apron made by his mother. And 19-year-old Justine Tucker sewed. She had an active Etsy shop where she took orders for Halloween costumes and flower girl attire. Upon graduating from high school, Justine was hired by a community college to create the costumes for upcoming productions of Our Town and Once on This Island. Because the interests of her family members had come so naturally to them, and because university seemed like an acceptable place to wait for her hands to find themselves, Amira became the first person in her family to attend a 4-year college. It was Temple University where she met Zara, in line to take her student ID photo, where she got drunk for the first time, she threw up into the side pocket of her purse, and where she purchased her first weave from the funds she saved working in the library in between classes, long and black and wavy and big. Amira tried to make her hands find formal sign language at Temple, but it was surprisingly difficult to unlearn the conversational slang she grew up with back in Sewell Bridge. Amira also tried transcription, which seemed like a career path and narrative that made sense. In her senior year, Amira typed lecture notes for two deaf students for $13 per class. This was more or less the reason she ended her 5 years at Temple with a major in English. Amira didn't mind reading or writing papers, but this was also mostly the problem. Amira didn't love doing anything, but she didn't terribly mind doing anything either. After graduation, Amira went home for the summer and desperately missed Philadelphia. She returned with a stern suggestion from her father, to find something and to stick with it. So, Amira enrolled in transcription school, and she absolutely hated it. She wasn't allowed to cross her legs. Memorizing medical terminology was insufferable, and when a key on her steno machine broke, instead of fixing it, which would have cost hundreds of dollars, Amira gave it up completely and applied to a part-time job she found on Craigslist. In a small office on the sixth floor of a high-rise building, in a large cubicled room labeled Green Party Philadelphia, a white woman in a t-shirt and jeans named Beverly asked Amira if she could really type 125 words per minute. "I can," Amira said, "as long as you don't mind if I cross my legs." In a tiny corner with squishy headphones, on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 12 to 5 p.m., Amira transcribed text from speeches and meetings. When things got slow, Beverly asked her to cover the phones. Temple University had been kind to keep Amira as an on-call transcriber for the 2 years following her graduation, but they wanted to keep entry-level employment open to current students and gave her fair warning that she'd have to move on by summer. Amira hadn't told her parents about her departure from transcription school. She wanted to be able to replace it with something rather than a passionless negative space. In a quiet panic, Amira changed her availability on sittertown.com to Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and 2 days later, she met Alix Chamberlain. Briar was a welcome break from Amira's constant concern of what to do with her hands and the rest of her life. Briar asked questions like, "Why can't I smell that?" Or, "Where's that squirrel's mama?" Or, "How come we don't know that lady?" Once, after Briar tried zucchini for the first time, Amira stood in front of her high chair and asked the toddler if she liked it. Briar chewed with her mouth open and looked all over the room as she articulated her response. "Mira, how, because how do you know when you like it? Who says when you like it?" Amira was fairly certain that the caregiver-approved answer was something like, "You'll figure it out," or "It'll make sense when you're older." But Amira wiped the toddler's chin and said, "That's a really good question. We should ask your mom." She honestly meant it. Amira wished that someone would tell her what she liked doing best. The number of things she could ask her own mother were shrinking at an alarming rate. Amira hadn't told her parents that she was babysitting and typing for a living, which meant she couldn't tell them about the night at Market Depot. Not that they would have any insights she hadn't heard before, but it would have been nice to safely share her frustrations. In the fourth grade, a white classmate had marched to Amira's lunch table and asked her if she was a coon. Upon hearing this, her mother had promptly picked up the phone while asking Amira, "What's his name?" Amira was once followed by sales associates in Brooks Brothers while she shopped for a Father's Day gift. Her mother had said, "They ain't got nothing better to do." And once, after a bikini wax was completed, Amira was told that because she had ethnic texture, the total came to $40 instead of the advertised $35. To this, Amira's mother had responded, "Back up, you got what waxed?" It would have been nice to talk to her parents about the night at Market Depot, because it was honestly the biggest thing to happen to Amira in a while.
and it involved her favorite little person. Emira knew that she should have been mostly disturbed by the blatant bigotry of the altercation. But more than the racial bias, the night at Market Depot came back to her with a nauseating surge and a resounding declaration that hissed, "You don't have a real job." This wouldn't have happened if you had a real fucking job, Emira told herself on the train ride home, her legs and arms crossed on top of each other. You wouldn't leave a party to babysit. You'd have your own health insurance. You wouldn't be paid in cash. You'd be a real fucking person. Taking care of Briar was Amira's favorite position so far. But Briar would someday go to school. Mrs. Chamberlain didn't seem to want Catherine out of her sight. And even if she did, part-time babysitting could never provide health insurance. By the end of 2015, Emira would be forced off her parents' health coverage. She was almost 26 years old. Sometimes, when she was particularly broke, Emira convinced herself that if she had a real job, a 9-to-5 position with benefits and decent pay, then the rest of her life would start to resemble adulthood as well. She'd do things like make her bed in the morning, and she'd learn to start liking coffee. She wouldn't sit on the floor in her bedroom, discovering new music and creating playlists until 3 a.m., only to put herself to bed and think, "Why do you do this to yourself?" She'd try out a new dating app, and she'd have more interesting interests to write about, activities other than hanging out with Zara, watching old music videos, painting her nails, and eating the same dinner at least 4 nights a week, a crockpot meal consisting of shredded chicken, salsa, and cheese. If Emira had a real job, she'd look at her wardrobe full of clothes from Strawberry and Forever 21 and decide it was past time for an upgrade. Emira constantly tried to convince herself that she could find another child, a little girl with nice parents who needed her full time. They'd keep her on the books and she could say she paid taxes. They'd take her on vacations and consider her part of the family. But when Emira saw other children, anyone who wasn't Briar Chamberlain, she felt viscerally disgusted. They had nothing interesting to say. Their eyes had dead, creepy stares, and they were modest in a way that seemed weirdly rehearsed. Emira often watched Briar approach other toddlers on swings and slides, and they'd turn away from her saying, "No, I'm shy." Other children were easy audiences who loved receiving stickers and hand stamps, whereas Briar was always at the edge of a tiny existential crisis. Underneath her constant chatter, Briar was messy and panicky and thoughtful, constantly struggling with demons of propriety. She liked things that had mint smells. She didn't like loud noises, and she didn't consider hugging a legitimate form of affection unless she could lay her ear against a welcoming shoulder. Most of their evenings ended with Emira paging through a magazine while Briar played in the bathtub. Briar sat with her toes in her hands, her face a civil war of emotions, singing songs and trying to whistle. She'd have private conversations with herself, and Emira often heard her explain to the voices in her head, "No, Mira is my friend. She's my special friend." Emira knew she had to find a new job. 4. The next morning, instead of setting Briar in front of a children's program about colorful fish and animals in the ocean, Alix strapped her children into the double jogging stroller. There was so much more room to run in Philadelphia. She didn't have to jog in place at stoplights to keep her heart rate up, and she didn't have to make it to the highway to see more than 100 steps ahead. Just after mile 3, which felt more like the 26th, both of her children had been rocked back to sleep. Alix stopped in a coffee shop, asked for a latte, and took it to a bench outside. "I need a conference call immediately," she texted. "No death or sickness, but very urgent." Alix had said the names Rachel, Jody, and Tamra so many times that there was no other way to say it. She hadn't texted her group of girlfriends this way since her move. Most of their recent conversations concerned other women they knew, product advice, articles and books they were reading, and complaints about their husbands. So, seconds after this text was sent, it was met back with two, "Are you okay?" texts, and one, "Tamra, can you start it?" Jody was a children's casting director who had two redheaded children, ages 4 and 1, who often appeared as crying extras on TV shows and movies. Rachel, proudly Jewish and Japanese, managed a firm that designed book covers while she tried to get her son to be not so good at soccer, because who the hell knew it was so intense? He was only 5 years old. And Tamra was the principal of a private school in Manhattan. Twice a year, the four women gorged on the wine, cheese, and hummus packages sent by parents trying to boost their children's admission applications or keep their problem child enrolled. Tamra had two girls with inch-long dark afros, a 2.5-year-old, and a fully literate 4-year-old who spoke beginner French. Tamra's children referred to her as Mimi. With her knees spread wide on the bench and cold sweat at her temples, Alix told them everything. Rachel gasped and said, "What?" In an overly enunciated tone, Tamra said, "They wouldn't let her leave?" Jody said, "All of this happened in one day?" "Jesus Christ, that would never happen in New York," Rachel said. "Hudson, get that out of your mouth." "Sorry, we're at soccer." Alix's heart sped up to the same sickening point as it had the night before, when Peter returned without Amira and said, "Okay, everyone's fine," before he explained. Alix couldn't help but ask what sounded like uselessly generic questions as soon as they left her lips. Was she crying? Was she mad? Did she seem really upset? If Alix had been asked about Amira and her mental state for all the Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays in the last 3 months, she wouldn't have had an answer. Most days, Alix practically threw Briar into Amira's arms on her way out the door, calling over her shoulder that Briar hadn't eaten lunch or hadn't really pooped. The Tuesdays and Thursdays without Amira included swimming lessons at the Y, where Briar swam so hard and desperately that she ended up taking 3-hour naps. These naps were followed by a movie on Netflix, and by the ending credits, Dada was walking through the front door. This pattern had sustained Alix so well that she had no idea if her babysitter was the type of person to cry, sue, or do nothing at all. Tamra clicked her tongue. "You gotta call that girl right now." "I'm Googling Peter's clip," Jody said. "Okay, 500 views, that's not awful." "Did anyone get a video of this?" Tamra asked. "You guys could probably help her sue the store," Rachel said. "I don't know, I'm freaking out." Alix placed her elbows at her knees. "I've been terrible to her. She's so good and she's so on time. Briar adores her, and I feel like I'm gonna lose her because of some stupid fucking grocery store cop." Alix removed the side of the seatbelt from Briar's sleeping mouth and looked around to make sure no one had heard her say the F word in front of her children. "I've just been so sloppy with everything lately that it all feels like a big punishment. I'm late with my book, I'm gaining weight, and I have a dozen of Peter's colleagues coming over today for Briar's birthday, which Amira was supposed to help with. But the thought of losing her forever is making me physically ill. I'll never be able to finish this book without her." "Hey," Rachel cut her off. "You will finish this book no matter what. You're a badass and you finish things. But right now, Amira is the first priority." Tamra said, 100%. "Prudence," Jody took her mouth away from the phone. You have to share with your brother. Is that understood? Then, closer to the receiver, she said, I agree with everything that was just said. Of course, I get that. And I know I need to call her, Alik said. But what? How do I go about this?
Don't tell her to write a letter, Rachel mumbled.
Jody said, Rachel, this is serious, in the same momish way she spoke to her daughter.
Honestly, Tamra said, she might not even answer, and you need to be prepared for that.
Next to Alik's, the bell attached to the coffee shop door rang as a couple came outside. The woman said, I bet we can rent it on Amazon. And the man replied, but 3D was the entire point. Alix dipped her head and sweat fell off her nose. I'm literally gonna be sick.
Hey, if she does answer, Tamra said, just tell her that you're so sorry that this happened and that you support her in whatever she needs, whether that means lawyering up or doing absolutely nothing.
Yeah, just don't get emotional, Rachel told her. Not that you would, but make it all about her.
Hudson, it's okay, bud. Rachel could be heard clapping her hand to her thigh. You want to go home?
No? Okay, fine.
Alix knew that this probably wouldn't have been so daunting if it wouldn't be the longest conversation she'd ever had with Amira. She took a deep breath and said, is this my fault for sending her there?
Oh, honey, no, Jody said.
I would have called her too, Tamra said.
It's your fault you moved to Philadelphia, Rachel said.
I'm sorry, but again, this would never happen in New York City. When I pick Hudson up from anywhere, they literally don't trust that he's my kid. But when Arnetta goes, they're like, here you go, he's allergic to nuts, bye.
Prue, Jody called. I'm gonna count to three, young lady. One, two, thank you, ma'am. Alix sat back and her sweaty top clung to her shoulder blades. In front of her, in her sleep, Catherine's bootied feet ran somewhere in her dreams. Tamra said, go call her. And Alix said, I know.
Alix?
Jody beckoned.
I love you and you're beautiful. You always are. But I'm being a good friend right now and asking how much weight you've gained.
Alix looked down toward her neon orange shorts, a mushy pudge made up of baby weight, a gym membership she'd never gotten, and sugar-based smoothies consumed in the sun poked out over her waistband and underneath the damp tank top. Alix sighed. I'm afraid to check.
Oh, God, Tamra said. Why didn't you say something earlier?
Okay, sweetie, Jody said. You need to get your SHIT together because you are not this person. You are so good at confrontation, and you breastfeed in front of audiences, and you are going to write a very successful book. You need to hang up the phone, beg your sitter to stay, tell Peter to watch his mouth, and get a Fitbit or something, okay?
Yeah, she's right, eh? Rachel added. 'Cause when your book comes out, your photo is gonna be everywhere and book covers add like 17 pounds. I am not kidding.
Consider this an intervention, Tamra agreed, but a very kind and very supportive one.
Do they have juice there? Rachel asked. Should I send you a cleanse?
I think they have juice, Rach, Jody laughed. It's not like she's in Montana.
Amira didn't answer her phone, so Alix took a shower and tried her again. This time she answered, and Alix delivered all the things her friends had suggested, mentally checking off each point. But as she said the words, it's completely your call,
Amira replied. Wait, am I late?
Alix heard Zara's voice in the background say, Who is calling you so early?
Alix looked at her watch. It was 9:14 a.m. Amira, Alix realized, was half asleep.
No, you're not late, Alix assured her. The party's still at noon, or 11:45, if you can come early. But you don't have to. But I'd love for you to come. We'd love for you to come. But it's up to you.
No, I'll be there, Amira said. I'm coming. Don't worry.
No, Amira, I wasn't checking up on you. I mean, I'm checking on you, Alix struggled. But just to see how you are. But okay, I'll see you at noon or 11:45? Zara's voice, now more awake, said, Would you get a bagel if I ordered one?
Alix said, See you soon. And Amira hung up the phone.
I called, Alix texted Tamra. It seemed like she didn't want to talk about it.
Tamra responded, That's her choice. Is she coming?
Yes.
Okay, be cool, Tamra texted back. Drink lots of water. No pasta. But you're allowed to eat cake because your baby is 3.
Alix looked to Briar, who was playing with 2 combs on the floor in her bedroom.
Bri, she said. Happy birthday, lovey.
To which Briar very seriously responded,
Is it happy birthday pretend?
If the decision had been Briar's, the theme of her party would have been glasses, because the toddler savagely wanted glasses, and to touch everyone else's glasses, and to see how she looked in all of the glasses. But Briar also loved airplanes, and pointing at them, and the sounds they made. And Alix felt that this, out of all of Briar's other interests, smelling tea bags, other people's belly buttons, touching the soft skin on Mama's earlobe, should be openly encouraged. Alix pushed the furniture in the living room back against the walls and then evenly spread out white balloons that covered the towering ceilings. Hanging at the bottom of each 20-foot string was a blue paper airplane with curved edges and wheels. Next, she set up a snack table, covered in a cloud-covered paper tapestry. By the door, she hung up soft aviator goggles meant for toddlers to take and wear. There were mini cupcakes dyed the color of the sky, and party favors were lined up in bright blue bags with tiny white propellers that could spin. Alix took close-up photos of the propellers and the cupcakes to post on her Instagram. So close-up that they could have been taken anywhere, particularly Manhattan. Peter brought a few of the balloons outside and taped them around the jagged hole in the window. When Alix peeked her head outside, he said, Is this dumb? She shook her head and felt a warm and sad affection for him. She knew he hadn't meant what he said on the news.
No, she said, it's not dumb.
Upstairs, Alix put on a loose-fitting denim jumpsuit and straightened her hair. Peter was singing Baby Beluga to Briar and Catherine, who lay on the bed as he secured his belt and buttoned his shirt. Between Way Down Yonder and Where the Dolphins Play, he stuck his head into the bathroom. She's still coming to help out, right? Alix looked at him through the mirror as she applied mascara to her bottom lashes. She said she was. Amira arrived at 11:45. She had her own key, and when the door closed downstairs, both Peter and Alix looked at each other above their children's heads. Briar was finally in her birthday outfit, a hunter green jumpsuit that made her resemble a Top Gun cast extra, and Catherine was cuddled in a cloud costume. Alix handed Peter a gold winged pin and said, Give us a minute, before she bolted down 2 sets of stairs. There was Amira hanging her backpack on the wall, in dark jeans, a loose braid down her back, and chunky black eyeliner.
In her first week of babysitting for the Chamberlains, Amira took Briar to a painting class. She'd been wearing an oversized knit cardigan, the kind that paint would never come out of, and Alix offered her one of her many white Let Her Speak polos. I actually have tons of these, and you're the same size as my old interns, she'd said. Well, they might be a bit big on you, but you're welcome to wear one anytime. This became Amira's uniform. 3 times a week, Alix came downstairs to find Amira slipping a white polo over her head. She hung it up on the coat rack just before she left. And suddenly, as Alix walked through blue ribbons hanging from the balloons above, the tenderness of this tradition made her throat start to close. She made it to the bottom step as Amira said, "Hey," and pulled her braid out of the back of her collar. "Hey, hi." Alix stood in front of Amira and held both her elbows. Can I give you a hug? This promptly felt like an ignorant response. Alix didn't want this to be their first hug, but she had offered and she had to commit. In her arms, Amira smelled like body butters, burnt hair, nail polish, and cheap perfume. First of all, Alix backed away. You do not have to be here today. Oh no, I'm here. It's cool. Amira turned to her backpack and took a chapstick out of the front pocket. Alix crossed her ankles and arms as she stood. I'm not going to even pretend to know what you're feeling right now or how you felt last night because I never truly will. But I just want to extend my support in whatever way you need it. If that's a lawyer, or a civil action suit, or... Amira smiled. A what? Amira, Alix said. She realized her shoulders were up by her ears, and she tried to bring them down into her back. You could sue that entire store. Seeking legal action is completely within your right. Oh, no. Amira pressed her lips together and sealed the lid of her bomb. I'm not trying to get into all that. Alix nodded. And I completely respect that. We just want you to know how sorry we are. And another voice from outside said, Alix? Behind Amira, the door slid open 2 inches. Amira reached for the knob and revealed 2 little boys and their mother, a family from Briar's swim class. Oh my God, hi, the woman said. I know, we're so early. Hi, I'm sure you're not even done setting up, but we can help and we won't be any trouble. You look so cute. Alix ushered them in with hi's and how are you's. The boys rushed the snack table and one of them took off his shoes. As the woman began to remove their jackets, Alix whispered to Amira, Let's talk about this later. It's okay, Amira said. It's honestly fine. As she said this, Amira dug into a paper bag that she'd set beneath her backpack. She pulled out a small bowl with an orange ribbon around the rim, holding a bright yellow goldfish inside. Oh, wait, Amira. Alix put her hand to her heart. Is that from you? Yeah. Amira placed the bowl on the mantel next to a little paper airplane that read, Presents land here. As she turned the bowl so that the ribbon faced forward, Alix remembered. Yes, Amira had asked if she could get Briar a fish for her birthday. She'd asked both Alix and Peter days ago. Alix hadn't considered it would be a real one because she hadn't really been listening. But here it was, gold and wiggling. Amira had curled the ribbon around the tiny bowl, but it had bent and flattened in transit and now hung bitterly around the rim. 2 minutes into their earliness, the first guest's 3-year-old threw up in the space next to the toilet seat, and he began to cry in an embarrassed whimper. By the time it was cleaned up and apologies had ceased, a group of Peter's co-workers from WNFT had arrived. Alix turned on some music, went to the door, and said,
"Hi, I think we met once before. I'm Alix."
When she met people for the first time, Alix overpronounced her name, Alix, with a strong emphasis on the second syllable. Peter never seemed like he was 8 years older than Alix. His waist was trim and his light haircut was boyish. But when she found herself in a room of his peers, Alix suddenly felt as if she were attending a gathering of her parents' friends and counting down till she could retreat to her room and watch music videos. Peter's female co-workers arrived in floral fit and flare dresses, wedges, and pumps. Even the one black woman there arrived with her hair teased, bobbed, and highlighted. These ladies wore massive statement necklaces with costumish gems and beads. The men looked like grown-up Ken dolls in khakis and golf shirts. The most popular point of conversation was the sharp hole in the foyer window. Before she'd learned of the incident at Market Depot, as she waited for the police to finish their report, Alix had worried that Peter's co-workers possibly felt the same as the juniors at Beacon Smith High, that Peter's career in Philadelphia had possibly ended before it began, and maybe they'd take him back at Riverdale, which would have been kind of amazing if it meant she'd be back in New York. But WNFT's reaction to the toothed hole in the window was a strange home-court pride mixed with backslapping joy. It was as if Peter, the new guy in town, had been properly and jokingly hazed. They wanted to know the story. They laughed and said, "Don't worry." They clinked their beers to the top of Peter's and said, "Well, welcome to Philadelphia." No one at Briar's birthday party had heard of Alix or Let Her Speak. As she sipped on a club soda underneath a playlist of Kidz Bop and Michael Jackson, Alix decided to consider her anonymity a research-based challenge, to develop a clear elevator pitch that might appear on her book's dust jacket, one of the many tasks she hadn't yet started, but none of her descriptions seemed to work.
"Oh, so you're not exactly writing the book," one woman said. "It's like, what was that thing called? Post Secret? Do you remember that? And it was like, super raunchy?"
"We saw some wacky movie called She. No, it was called Her."
"Her?"
Another wife looked to her husband for confirmation, but when he didn't give any, she still went on.
"Maybe it was Them. But anyway, this guy's job is to write love letters for people. People he doesn't even know. It was so strange. Is that what you do?"
Alix pretended to hear Catherine crying and politely excused herself. Lainey Thacker, Peter's co-anchor, arrived with her 4-year-old daughter, Bella. She also brought yellow roses, a bottle of wine, a mason jar filled with cookie ingredients and a recipe, and wrapped presents for both Briar and Alix. She greeted Alix with outstretched hands and a look that said, "It's finally happening."
"Oh my gosh, I just feel like I know you so well," she said. "Give me a hug. You're Philly Action family now."
Twice, Alix thought their hug had reached its limit, but Lainey hummed as she kept her hold. She gently rocked Alix from side to side. Bella went to Briar and rocked her back and forth as well. Back in Manhattan, Alix went to birthday parties at least twice a month with Rachel, Jody, and Tamara. They sat in corners drinking wine from paper cups and took turns dancing with the children. They whispered about obnoxious extravagances, like chocolate fountains or complete toddler makeovers, and they rolled their eyes at monogrammed favors and the hired Disney princess lookalikes who were always from New Jersey. But the guests attending Briar's very simple birthday party seemed to be trying twice as hard. The women dressed as if they were pretending to live on the Upper East Side,
not as if they actually did, or as if they'd actually been there. There was no way they were comfortable standing in pumps, and why wasn't anyone wearing jeans? Alix felt out of place and uncomfortably large. But Peter had smiled through Alix's luncheons and parties and conventions. He'd stayed up late next to his wife, stamping 500 letters that high school girls had written to their future selves. He'd put the children to bed when workshops ran late, after convincing Briar that her mother would come in and kiss her the very second she got home. Alix tried to remind herself of this and find someone she could relate to, someone she wouldn't mind coming over to plop her kid in front of the TV with Briar, someone she could go to yoga with. But these women were as pleasant and sweet as they were old-fashioned and disconcertingly uncool. Peter's co-anchor, Lainey, fondled the wrap on Alix's jumpsuit affectionately.
"I always want to try one of these," she said, "but I could never pull it off."
She leaned in to laugh and ask how Alix could pee in that thing anyway. Then it was apparently time for gifts. Children in Manhattan never opened presents at a party. Gifts were put in cabs and trunks, or in large, clear plastic bags to be taken home with leftover cake. If you remembered, you could hide a few in a closet and save them for a plane ride distraction, or for when your child peed in the proper place. But as Peter and Alix talked to a WNFT staff member, her five-year-old child came and clung to her knees.
"When are they gonna do presents and cake?" he whined.
Peter looked at Alix.
"Should I set up a chair?"
Briar sat on Alix's lap while Amira handed them presents. After the second gift, Briar became overwhelmed, flapped her arms, and said,
"I don't like it, I don't like it."
Amira and Peter soothed her as Alix unwrapped each gift. In between a make-your-own Jell-O princess mold and a tiara that reeked of toxins and plastic, Alix retrieved her cell phone from her pocket to text Rachel, Jody, and Tamara. "Kill me," she typed. "I hate everyone here." Every present given to Briar was completely ridiculous, borderline sexist, or horribly cliched. The three-year-old received a silver Fendi snowsuit, a white and pink little ladies' tea set, an edible arrangement — had they ordered this online? — and a birthday cake scented Yankee Candle with a Build-A-Bear gift card attached to the lid. At Alix's feet, Amira stuffed wrapping paper into a large recycling bag. Briar held up a gift in confusion, a frilly blue apron with matching bonnet. Amira said to her,
"That's for you, birthday girl."
Alix wanted to grab Amira's shoulders, both of them, and say into her face, "This party is not me." Alix's home was filled with the types of mothers she often saw in airports and had come to completely despise. Women with full faces of makeup, way too much luggage, Vera Bradley carry-ons and Lily Pulitzer passport cases, cork wedge sandals, and plastic bags with souvenirs that took up all the room in the overhead compartments. They noisily called their husbands as soon as they landed or to let them know they'd made it to the next gate. They held up the line to get off the plane. "Do you have everything? Because we cannot come back." In bathroom stalls, they detailed their activity of papier-mâcheing the seat with toilet paper rather than doing what Alix always did, chalking up public bathrooms to exercise and just squatting over the bowl. Alix didn't even own a stroller until she was pregnant a second time. She was an incredible packer, often only brought a backpack on weekend trips, and frequently found herself texting Peter that she'd jumped on another flight that got her home quicker. So, as she looked around her living room, Alix wondered how she would ever call Philadelphia home. How she could keep her dexterity as a mother and small business owner while surrounded by the type of woman who halted security check flow because she'd forgotten to remove her jacket. Alix stood by the door as parents struggled to squeeze shoes back on their children's feet
and the toddlers began to rummage through their favors. She said, "We have to get the kids together," about four times as her cheek was kissed and her hands were squeezed. Again, Lainey made her way to Alik's for a heartfelt moment of connection.
"I'm just so glad you guys are here," she said. "We gotta do some cocktail time after the babes fall asleep."
It was clear that Lainey was being very friendly, but also assuring Alik's that while she sat next to her husband every day, she was a girl's girl, and that there was no funny business going on. This had never even crossed Alix's mind, and she felt guilty that it hadn't. Lainey had an embarrassing laugh, a disproportionate gum-to-teeth ratio, and she often said things like, "Holy moly!" Lainey was the definition of sweet, and as Alix hugged her, she thought, "I want to like you. Why is this so hard?" Over Lainey's shoulder, Alix watched Amira bend down to help a little boy into his jacket.
"We didn't play my favorite game," the five-year-old told her.
"Oh, yeah?" Amira pulled the sleeves down onto his hands. "What's your favorite game?" He turned around to her and said,
"My favorite game is called I'm a Murderer."
"Cool." Amira stood up and walked to the next room, calling out, "Hey, Briar, come hold my hand real quick." After Alix finally closed the door behind Lainey and her family, she pulled out her phone again. "Correction," she texted her friends. "I hate everyone except for my sitter."
"You better give that girl a raise," Tamra said.
"Or an edible arrangement," Rachel replied.
That night, Briar went to bed with her new fish on her nightstand, one of the few gifts Alix didn't place in a donation bag. Newly three-year-old Briar promptly named the fish Spoons and watched it swim in circles until she fell asleep. 5. Just as Amira decided to distance herself from the now three-year-old girl, to check Craigslist and Indeed every day, and to only apply for jobs that hired adults and offered very adult benefits, Mrs. Chamberlain stepped in hard. The night at Market Depot had done something to her, and she tried to right the night's wrongs with a forced casualness that made Amira quite cagey. Since that night, Mrs. Chamberlain started returning home at 6:45, sitting down across from Amira and referencing conversations that they'd never had. "Amira, remind me what you majored in. Tell me where you live again. Did you say that you had any allergies?" The timing couldn't have been worse. These were the questions you asked at the beginning, and not at what Amira was trying to make the end. But for a part-time gig, the money was decent, making it difficult to get excited about potential jobs that offered less money and zero Briar. Every other Friday, Alix handed Amira an envelope with $672 inside. 2 weeks after the night at Market Depot, this envelope felt particularly fat. On the front porch, underneath a flushed sunset, Amira peeked inside the envelope flap to reveal $1,200 in cash. A small note on thick cardstock was paperclipped to the $100 bills, with Alix's brilliant handwriting on one side. "Amira," it read, "this is for the past 2 weeks, Briar's birthday, and the awful night when you completely saved us. Thank you for everything. We love having you, and we're here for you. XO, P, A, B, and C." Amira looked down the street. She laughed, whispered, "Fuck," and immediately purchased her first leather jacket. The subway was packed. Amira was pleasantly late to meet Zara, Shawnee, and Josepha for a dinner, followed by drinks, followed by all the other practices of 20-somethings in the nighttime. Everything she wore looked shiny next to her new jacket. It was black with asymmetric zip fastening and was cropped just above her hip.
The belt hung effortlessly at her sides, and she let the silver zippers sit open at her forearms. Amira's jacket came in at $234, making it the biggest purchase she'd ever made other than her bed frame and laptop. With one hand holding the subway pole and the other texting Zara that she was on her way, Amira found it both funny and sad that she could feel so cheap in the most expensive thing she owned. She turned her earbuds up loud and balanced into the subway's turns. Behind Amira was a family of six, very much not from Philadelphia, and the mother was calling out, "The next stop is ours, does everyone hear me?" Underneath her music, she listened to the conversation to her left, where a man in a suit was saying he needed an excuse to not attend a family function. The woman next to him said, "I don't mind if you blame me." Amira's hip bones were prominent beneath her black leggings, and when she caught a flash of her gold multi-chain necklace, she flattened it out against her chest in the window reflection of fast-moving concrete and darkness. She smoothed her bangs and the dark waves at her shoulders, and in the space between one song ending and another beginning, she heard someone call her name. Amira turned to see KellyTCopeland@gmail.com. Over baseball hats and ponytails and shoulders, he said her name again, but this time he said, "Amira Tucker." Amira readjusted her grip on the subway pole and found herself remarkably nervous. He was cuter this time around, partially because Amira wasn't babysitting or being accused of a crime, but he was also just cuter on his own. Kelly Copeland had dark hair and eyes, a long, pale face, and a big, strong-looking chin that for some reason implied he'd played sports all through college. Amira smiled from one side of her mouth, and Kelly said, "Excuse me," as he inched his way toward her. "Do you remember me?" "Of course you do. Hi." Kelly laughed as he answered his own question. "I probably shouldn't say this, but I've drafted about 6 emails to you, and I've never sent them." He paused. "I've gotta know if you quit or not." Amira was still startled by his very tall and friendly presence. She crossed her standing legs and said, "Sorry, what?" "Sorry," he said. "I was curious if you quit your nanny job." Kelly Copeland was so tall that he could press his hands flat against the top of the subway car, which was what he did in front of Amira. Amira thought this was both a painfully obvious show of masculinity and also insanely attractive. "Oh, sorry," Amira said. "Well, I'm actually not a nanny." "Wow," he said. "So you did quit. Good for you." "Oh, no, I'm still working." Amira switched her purse strap from her right shoulder to her left. "But yeah, I'm just a sitter. I'm not a nanny."
"Can you tell me what the difference is?" Kelly asked. "I'm not trying to be weird. I honestly don't know."
The subway car stopped, and Amira stepped out of the way of a man with 4 shopping bags as he exited the train. Kelly motioned the empty seat to her, and Amira sat down. "Nannies are full-time," she said. "They're salaried, and they get bonuses and vacations, and babysitters are part-time, and they do, like, date nights, and emergencies."
"Okay, got you," Kelly said. "Sorry, I thought I heard you say you were a nanny at the store that night."
"No, yeah, I said I was a nanny so that guy would leave me alone," Amira explained, which obviously worked really well.
"Right."
Kelly gave her the kind of goofy, annoyed look that passengers exchange when there's a loud, drunk person on a train, or when the conductor keeps announcing that there will be more delays.
"Well, if you stayed, you obviously had a reason to. But I'm hoping you got a raise at the very least."
Amira swiped a strand of hair out of her lashes, and the zipper at her sleeve jingled delightfully. She smiled and said, "They took care of me." Kelly leaned both of his hands on the bar above Amira's head.
Where are you going right now? He asked. Amira raised an eyebrow. She looked up at him and couldn't help but think, really?
It was Kelly's casual determination, mixed with the sight of 12 uncreased $100 bills, that gave her the spirit to think, you know what? Yeah, okay. Fuck it.
She pursed her lips and said, dinner with some friends, and then Luca's.
Why?
Luca's? He put out impressed lips and said, that's very fancy.
Amira raised her shoulders in a sweet, I don't know, motion.
What if I buy you a drink real quick? He said.
Then we can go our separate ways. I'm meeting friends tonight, too.
The train stopped, and a woman pushed past Kelly to claim the seat next to Amira. Amira feigned reluctance. She was enjoying this as much as he was. She was counting down to the last time she would see him tonight, and from what she could tell, it would be around 2 a.m.
I'm already late, she said. You could buy me a drink at Luca's, though.
Kelly laughed. Yeah, I'm never gonna get in there.
Amira looked down at his shoes. They were laced and brown, beneath dark jeans and an expensive-looking gray hoodie.
You're dressed okay, she assured him. You should be fine.
I didn't mean my clothes, but thank you. I am now brimming with confidence, he said with a grin. It's just, I've heard they don't let you in that place unless you're with a woman.
Amira's stop was next, and as the train started to slow, she stood up in the space next to him.
Well, you have my email. Just shoot me a note and I'll come outside.
Kelly pulled his phone out.
Wouldn't it be easier to text you?
Amira exhaled in a laugh.
You can email me, son.
Right, totally. He put his phone away with an obvious duh expression. I was gonna say the same thing. Email, cool.
Amira said, mm-hmm,
and stood by the double exit doors. Kelly sat in Amira's previous spot, which looked much too small for him and his frame. He rested his hands between his knees and smiled aggressively at Amira. She raised her eyebrows again and dropped her eyes down to her phone.
That's my girlfriend, he said loudly to the woman sitting next to him.
The woman looked up from the book she was reading and said, hmm?
That's my girlfriend right there.
Kelly pointed at Amira. The woman's face came into curiosity. She looked to Amira, who shook her head and said,
that's not true.
She does this, Kelly said, keeping his eyes on the woman to his right.
It's cute. She plays this game when we're on the train where she pretends like she doesn't know me.
Oh my God. Amira placed three fingers to her forehead.
When we get home, she goes, wasn't that funny, babe? And then we laugh about it. It's hilarious.
The woman laughed and said,
that's really romantic.
The train stopped and Amira said, bye.
Kelly called out, see you at home, honey.
And the doors slid shut behind her. At Luca's, Shawnee requested a booth on the balcony and bottle service, to which Zara said,
excuse me, bish.
And Shawnee replied,
what? It's on me.
In a plush booth with white leather seats, the four girls sipped their drinks and bounced to the music. Shawnee ordered a second bottle, and when it arrived, Josepha held up her phone to announce to Snapchat,
we having a blessed motherfucking night, okay?
Shawnee's parents were as rich as Shawnee was generous. Her family's money came from a southern chain of drive-through laundromats, and Shawnee's big-heartedness stemmed from a deep belief in karma, as well as inspirational quotes found online. Ever since they'd met, Zara had come to Amira after class and said, this light-skinned girl offered to take us to a concert, and she might kill us, but it also might be dope. Shawnee was constantly offering up her wardrobe, a first round of drinks, and the other half of her queen-sized bed. When Amira spent the night on Shawnee's couch, she'd wake up sweating beneath a blanket that Shawnee had applied sometime in the night. Josepha, Shawnee's roommate, was as inconsistent as Shawnee was reliable. She either stayed at home, glued to her phone and new memes and videos, speaking to her sister and mother in Spanish via FaceTime, or she wanted to rally and drink until sunrise. Josepha went to Boston University and was now a research assistant and fellow at Drexel. Her parents said they'd support her financially as long as she was in school. She currently was in the process of getting her second master's, this one in public health.
I invited this guy here, but I don't think he'll come.
Amir said this to Zara as they danced in front of their booth, behind the railing that looked down to the first floor.
I met him on the train, but it's whatever.
He got friends?
That's what he said.
Zara nodded that she'd understood, and then put her leg on the table so she could twerk to the side. Shawnee leaned her ear in to say,
Boys are coming tonight.
No, no, Amira shook her head. Probably not.
Zara pushed Shawnee's shoulder as she danced and said,
It doesn't matter because you have a boyfriend.
Shawnee raised her hands in defense.
I was just asking.
Josepha announced,
I want a picture.
In the reflection from her phone's screen, the girls were in order from lightest to dark. Josepha with her thick brown hair and glossed pink lips. Shawnee with her curls and honeyed round face. Zara with her freshly done twists and massive smile.